This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, August 11th. I'm Jeffrey Toobin, filling in today for Dorothy Wickenden. The past week has marked an alarming escalation of tensions between the United States and North Korea. Over the weekend, the United Nations Security Council voted unanimously to impose strict new sanctions on Pyongyang, and on Tuesday, President Trump held a press conference from his golf club in New Jersey, where he is vacationing, to discuss the situation.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Last night, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, in a rare interview, was asked to clarify the president's remarks.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days. I think the president, again, as commander in chief, I think he felt it necessary to issue a very strong statement directly to North Korea. But I think what the president was just reaffirming is the United States has the capability to fully defend itself from any attack and defend our allies, and we will do so.
John Cassidy joins me to discuss the Trump administration's apparently mixed messages to Pyongyang and what this means for the country's national security and foreign policy moving forward. Cassidy, welcome.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for inviting me on.
Let's start by talking about the president's statement, because, you know, I feel like we're going back to the campaign where people were saying, don't take him literally, take him seriously. But let's parse the statement. North Korea best not make any threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. So let's take the first part of that. Responding to threats had not been American policy towards North Korea. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right, Jeff. All administrations, basically going all the way back to the Clinton administration in the 90s, had taken the attitude of sort of, you know, North Korea can say anything it wants. It's the actions that count. The U.S. would respond to any attack, but, you know, a threat is a threat, and we're much bigger than them. We don't have to take any notice of that, just words. What he seemed to be saying, that the U.S. would, you know, launch a nuclear attack just because it was threatened. And that was obviously, if he meant it, a huge change in policy.
That's the second part of the sentence. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. The world has seen nuclear weapons used by the United States in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the implication, you're saying, was we will respond with our nuclear weapons.
It wasn't clear. That was the problem. It was completely unclear. If you assume that fire and fury in the world like the world has never seen before, that seems to be referring to, you know, a large-scale nuclear attack. The U.S. obviously has got the capability to destroy Korea many, many, many times over if it chose to with its nuclear arsenal. So that's he seems to be referring to nuclear weapons. And then the second half of the problem was that he seemed to be saying that we might use nuclear weapons in response to a threat. That is what prompted Tillerson and Mattis to come out with sort of clarifying statements later in the day. But the problem was that even they weren't particularly consistent.
So Tillerson, we just heard the quote, basically says no change, that American policy hasn't changed.
Right. His message was nothing new here.
Right.
The president is just reiterating our existing stance, but using more colorful language because Kim Jong-un wasn't listening to diplomatic language. Tillerson actually said he doesn't seem to understand diplomatic language. This was President Trump talking to him in the language he might understand.
Secretary of Defense Mattis also issued a statement where he spoke very specifically about any actions by North Korea will be responded to, not threats.
That again was saying that U.S. policy hasn't changed. Mattis was, in a way, contradicting Trump by saying that we're not responding to threats, we're responding to actual actions. But he also gave the president some cover by using some very sort of aggressive language as well, saying, you know, if the North Koreans did take any action, it would lead to, you know, the end of the nation. And he sort of converted Trump's fire and fury language into what I called in a post Pentagonese. But the crucial distinction was that this U.S. counterattack would come in response to not just a verbal threat, but some actual action on behalf of the North Koreans.
Okay, so the president says any threats will be met with fire and fury. After that, North Korea threatens Guam.
Right.
So we haven't seen the fire and fury yet, but why Guam? I mean, what? How did Guam get into the equation?
Guam is a big U.S. base in the Pacific, and it is the home to some B-1B bombers, which the U.S. uses to fly over the Korean Peninsula, and the North Koreans don't like that at all. And there was an overflight of Korea on Sunday after the U.N. sanctions were introduced, and it seems like the North Korean military were responding to that. And they said there were two different statements. The later one, which is particularly alarming, said that they're going to launch missile tests for missiles in a couple of weeks. These missiles would overfly Japan and then land just 30, 40 miles from Guam. That seems to be North Korea, far from backing down, you know, raising the stakes even further.
Okay, we've now more or less completed our close textual analysis of the various statements. John, can you tell me what American policy is currently?
Well, the Trump administration's official policy was engage and pressure, or pressure and engage. The pressure economic through sanctions, which they managed to get through, actually a big victory for the Trump administration. They got the Russians and the Chinese to support stronger sanctions at the UN. They've been ratcheting up the sort of military pressure with these overflights, and in terms of rhetoric as well, obviously saying, you know, things like Trump said the other day. But the other side of this was engagement. There was a sort of olive leaf out there that if North Koreans agreed to halt their missile tests, there would be the offer of negotiations. Trump, you'll remember, at one point even said he'd be happy to meet with him, have a hamburger with him. In fact, he even said it would be an honor to meet Kim Jong-un at one point. And they were relying on the Chinese to try and effect some changes too. That policy didn't seem to have much impact. The North Koreans have just carried on with their heightened schedule of missile tests. And then a couple of days ago, we got this report that from the Washington Post that the Defense Intelligence Agency has concluded that they've already miniaturized a weapon which could be fitted onto an intercontinental ballistic missile that gives them the ability to strike at American cities on the mainland. But still, having said all that, the official U.S. policy still is pressure and engage. They haven't given up the engagement. And so you saw Tillerson, when he came out and made his statement after Trump's statement, he did say this is all intended to persuade the North Koreans to reconsider the course they're on and move towards dialogue.
I think everyone is aware of the incredible difficulties of a military strike. Any sort of American military strike will be met with missiles and artillery raining down on Seoul with catastrophic casualties. All right, so I think everybody's aware of that. But is there something diplomatically or economically or in some other way that the United States and its allies can do that it's not doing?
That's what's quite strange about this sort of sudden ratcheting up by Trump. They actually did get these new sanctions through the UN on Saturday. The Chinese play a key role here because it seems like the Chinese have played a key role over the last few years in procuring a lot of the advanced technology which the North Koreans have used to build these missiles. And the problem with previous sanctions is the Chinese basically didn't go along with them, so they didn't have much impact. What was new here over the weekend was, and Tillerson again made a big deal of this, was that the Chinese and the Russians agreed to vote with the U.S. in imposing stricter sanctions. So you would think the logical thing to do after you've done that would be, you know, to give the sanctions at least some time to work. And that's what I think the Chinese and the Russians were expecting. So what you've seen the last couple of days, a lot of anger and sort of mystification in the Far East about Trump's statement, because it looked like the U.S. policy was actually succeeding to some extent, but Trump has sort of jumped off that track and got into a sort of verbal escalation.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
One of the questions that always comes up with North Korea, I mean, they are, of course, infamous for their rhetoric. And Kim Jong-un is very young. I mean, what's his goal here? What's he trying to accomplish?
I mean, obviously, I don't know Kim Jong-un. What I do know that the people who follow this closely, diplomats, U.S. diplomats, and especially Chinese diplomats, they think that this is a deliberate strategy. And the idea is that they just kind of carry on their own way, do everything they can to get a limited nuclear arsenal, establish a deterrent, and that will solidify the regime and make it absolutely clear that nobody can come in and take him down. And that they're willing to do anything to do that. If it involves starving the people in Korea, they'll go along with it. If it involves even some limited military conflict, they're willing to go along with that too. And most people think that they've actually been, you know, pretty successful with this strategy, and they've succeeded a lot more rapidly than most Western analysts thought. I mean, the U.S. response has been the sort of demanding denuclearization and offering various sort of carrots to North Koreans to go along with it. But that policy, unfortunately, has just failed. The North Koreans didn't take any notice of it. So the big question is now, given that that policy has failed, what do you do? And there only seem to be two options. One is to say, okay, we tried, it didn't work, now we have to accept a nuclear-armed North Korea and deal with it like we deal with all nuclear-armed states, through arms control and trying to ensure that they have proper command and control structures, etc., so that proper communication, so there is no sort of accidental nuclear incident. And a lot of experts in the field think that's where we're going to end up, that we don't have any choice, we're going to go down that path. The other option is to say, okay, we've still got 12 months or maybe 6 months or whatever. There's still room for a sort of last-minute intervention, which either would work because they would agree to stop their armament regime. I don't think that's going to happen. Or some sort of military action to stop them. The problem is it's very hard to see what sort of military action would be effective, at least without causing enormous casualties in South Korea and possibly Japan as well.
One fact that's, you know, hovering over this story is that the State Department is very shorthanded. There's no Assistant Secretary for East Asia. There's no ambassador to South Korea. The senior diplomat in Beijing resigned in protest over the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. Do you think that has any relevance to how this is all unfolding?
I think in the U.S. government as a whole, there are still a lot of people who understand what's going on here and have been following it closely in the Pentagon, the State Department, and even the National Security Council. I think the larger question is whether, you know, who's Trump listening to? Is he listening to the voices who are saying, we've tried this policy and it's failed, I'm afraid we're just going to have to accept a sort of nuclear Korea? Or is he, our people, the military, especially telling him, look, Mr. President, there are still some options here, military options we could take, and it's at least, you know, worth going further down that route. That's what's not clear from the outside. If you listen to Mattis, for example, a couple of months ago, he gave that speech in which he said any conflict in the Korean Peninsula would be absolutely catastrophic and would be warfare on a scale that we've never seen before, which, you know, that seemed to be suggesting that he was completely ruling it out as an option. But what he said yesterday about the U.S. Wiping North Korea, not destroying the regime and the people, etc. If there is an attack, that seemed a lot more, or somewhat more ominous. I mean, as I said, whether that was just meant to back up Trump or whether it was marked a change in U.S. policy, it's just not clear at this stage.
And likewise, I assume it's not clear what precisely Trump was trying to accomplish with this very inflammatory statement.
There's been various bits of reporting out of the White House on this. Initially, it seemed like he just sort of said it off the top of his head, that he hadn't discussed it with anybody else. I mean, that was one of the bizarre things about this incident. He gave this very bellicose, militaristic statement at a summit on opioid addiction during his summer vacation.
Seated next to his wife and the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which made the whole thing look sort of surreal.
Yeah, no, exactly. So it seemed to come out of nowhere. Subsequently, has been reported that he did speak with former General Kelly, the new chief of staff, a short conversation maybe about how they'd respond to questions about Korea because they knew they were doing a press availability. The understanding was that Trump would say something sort of firm, but I don't think Kelly or anybody else expected him to go this far. There are even some speculation that he'd been using similar language in other contexts, and he didn't really mean what he said, or he didn't really know what he was saying. That's the problem with Trump. You never know for sure. He's actually come out again on Thursday afternoon and defended his own statement in another press availability at the White House, saying maybe the problem with it was it wasn't tough enough. So, you know, he never admits that he's wrong.
And toughness is, you know, one of the cardinal virtues in the way Trump talks. The other possibility which has been raised is, you know, before we conclude, we can't ever let a week go by without talking about Russia and the investigation. Do you think this was an intentional attempt to distract?
That question is always there with Trump, obviously. And he certainly thinks a lot of his tweets about various things are attempted distractions. On this one, though, I don't know. There hasn't been any sort of independent reporting out of the White House supporting that. You never know what Trump's motives are at any one time. If he was aiming to do that, he certainly was effective. But it only worked for a day because, you know, the day later, the news that the FBI had raided Manafort's house was all over the place. So I think even Trump at this stage must realize that he can't knock the Russia story completely off the headlines. And the fact is, you know, the North Korean issue is a really serious, pressing issue, and he's going to be asked about it every time he appears anywhere.
Okay, John, where do we go from here on North Korea? What happens now?
Well, it looks like, you know, everything's heading towards Guam. The North Koreans have issued this statement you mentioned, saying that they're going to fire some intercontinental ballistic missiles towards the island in a couple of weeks. At the same time, the U.S. is going to be conducting its annual military exercises off Korea. So I think we're going to have a couple of very hot weeks, unfortunately, coming up, in which the rhetoric, I know it's already very hot, but it may get even hotter. The big question is, if the North Koreans, I'm sure the U.S. administration, Japan has already said that if they do launch these missiles, they wouldn't have a warhead on, we don't think, so they're not going to blow things up. If they fire it over Japan, they're going to respond in a strong way. The Japanese have already said that today.
What does that mean?
Well, we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know. They have anti-missile systems, which they could try and shoot one down, for example. The U.S. hasn't really said anything yet about how it would respond to it, but the U.S. also has extensive anti-missile systems on Guam itself, and they have battleships in the area which are even more effective anti-missile systems. So a lot of people think the U.S. would try and shoot down these missiles. Problem is, it might not work. These anti-missile systems are still basically in the testing stage, so it could be that the U.S. fire up these anti-missile missiles and they miss, and that would be seen as a great victory for Kim Jong-un and the North Koreans, I think. But anyway, this story is going to continue for at least a couple of weeks until we get these military exercises and the North Korean threat to Guam out of the way.
John Cassidy, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff. Sorry for being so depressing, but it's a pretty depressing story.
Like so many. John Cassidy is a staff writer and a regular political columnist for NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app of choice. And you can find more political analysis and commentary at NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Jeffrey Toobin, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. We'll be off next week, returning the week of August 21st.